welcome to another edition of Ecotextile Talks. I'm Philip Berman. Now, there was a time in the not-so-distant past when environmental and social governance, or ESG for short, meant a company could tweet about its worthy goals and maybe produce a glossy annual mission statement, on recycled paper, of course, and that was job done. But those days are over, with a raft of new proposals on the way aimed at putting ESG on a statutory footing. Now, this should be a good thing for the environment and the human rights of some of the poorest workers in the industry, but it also presents additional risks to many companies involved in the various parts of the supply chain. That's why we're joined today by Randy Rankin. He heads the audit team at Eurofins Consumer Products Assurance and spends a lot of his time talking to and helping textile and apparel companies manage and mitigate their risks. We had a fascinating conversation and spoke at length at the various problems posed by the new regulations and what companies should do about them. But I started off by asking Randy when and how he got involved in the social risk business.
I started working in this space in the late 1990s when companies began to get the first questions and challenges about working conditions in their supply chains. So large entities, mostly in the U.S. and the first generation, people like Nike, Disney, Walmart, were seeking help with understanding how you manage risks related to working conditions in the supply base, really as the first generation of what was then thought of as sort of CSR.
What is the first generation? What does that refer to?
I think when you look at this market space, the initial efforts were very much driven around understanding working conditions in the supply chain, looking at issues like child labor, forced labor, health and safety, which today we would consider an element of really product quality, not just what is the product, but what are the conditions under which the product was manufactured. It has over time expanded to include a much greater concern about environmental risks and environmental considerations. So it is an ever-evolving set of considerations.
So, and how did you end up at Eurofins then?
So I've been in the space for a long time. A former sort of colleague, a person I served on a board for a professional standards body with, came to Eurofins in 2019. He reached out to me and looking to develop an audit business, particularly a social audit business where I have a great deal of experience, suggested that be a great chance to build a business within a larger company, which having worked in both large and small companies, struck me as a great opportunity, working for a great company with a really good group of people.
Why the whole kind of area of risk in ESG? Why does that fascinate you? Why are you so sort of kind of motivated to be involved in that area?
It is an area that presents an opportunity to make a significant difference in the lives of people globally. I'm an accountant by background. I spent time working in that space. And when we think about doing things that have a real impact, the work that I've been involved with for the last 20 years has resulted, and it's something I share with our teams on the ground around the world, that people have access to clean drinking water or they're not being treated improperly. The work that we do makes a difference in that way. So you're impacting the lives of people, some of whom you'll never meet.
So there's a real socially purposeful element to it. And it seems like you've kind of got yourself involved in a really fascinating area. And we're now going to move on to the whole kind of main purpose of today's chat, Randy, because I know you spend quite a lot of time talking to various different clients who you advise around all the risks in that area around ESG. What do you see as the biggest risks coming down the track? Or maybe they've even already arrived at the station?
Well, I think the trend toward statutory due diligence in the supply chain is clearly one of the most important risks that we're facing globally. That, you know, it is the case that governments, if you look at social performance and environmental performance in the supply chain, it has historically been largely voluntary. It's been driven by companies who are doing things aligned with their values and in an effort to help their reputation. But it hasn't been driven by legal requirements. And so when you look at things like the EU directive on corporate sustainability, due diligence in the supply chain, the New York Fashion Act, the emergence of statutory requirements to do these things as opposed to them being sort of voluntary and values-based, and then the scope of those requirements is probably the most important thing that's happened in this space in the last 10 or 15 years. I think when you look at the history, there has been waves, right? You have a tragedy or a significant event that increases consciousness and awareness about conditions in the supply base. One would look at things like Rana Plaza in Bangladesh in 2013, where suddenly there is an increased level of interest and effort and engagement. But that's, again, that was not done historically in response to legal requirements. And so this trend toward legal requirements is a very significant element.
So I wanted to really pick up on a point you just made then, looking at those drivers for legislative change. You kind of preempted my next question, which is is it those sort of big headline grabbing disasters and events like the Rana Plaza, which have, you feel, pushed forward this acceleration in the legislative field companies? I mean, that's particularly apparel and textile, but is that where you feel like the main driver is coming from?
Well, I think there are two drivers there, really. There is the change in consumer perception and expectation that is driving some of that. And equally, there is investor engagement, right? So there is an increased level of interest and concern, and it manifests itself, particularly when you get into the investor realm, with efforts to provide information that allow for efficient operation of capital markets. That if, in fact, ESG issues, which we know is the case, are an increasingly important element for investor consideration, understanding those risks, the company's view about those risks, and what they're doing to manage and mitigate those risks becomes important. It's also the case that because it applies to the supply chain, you end up with very, very large companies that are at the point of this, but because they're dealing with what they're doing with their supply base, even small and medium enterprises deeper in the supply chain are suddenly being caught up in that requirement or expectations around information and disclosure.
And then some of that is obviously related to the whole globalization issue, which we've discussed before on this podcast, where there's geographically big distance between where companies based and sometimes where products are made. And there's sometimes lots of different levels as well, lots of different tiers along the supply chain from where the raw product might come to and right across to where the final product is delivered. So that, I guess, is also the complexities of the supply chain have also perhaps added additional risks to the whole process.
The nature of supply chains, particularly in the apparel space, is a key contributing factor here. And you've seen increased interest and awareness of those interdependencies. COVID actually impacted a great deal of that. It was one of the things that, from a business perspective, was a driver of companies' need to have a better understanding of the composition of their supply base, that they may know who's cutting and sewing the final product. But as a result of COVID, there was a keen appreciation for material dependencies and those opaque links in the supply base.
You've got a lot of clients in the textile and apparel industry. What current laws are your clients most wanting advice or help on?
The laws being enacted, both when you look at statutory due diligence in Europe, whether it be the country-specific statutes that have been recently put in place in places like France and Germany, or the EU directive intended to provide a broader sort of look across the European Union. The New York Fashion Act would be an example of something that's in work that is of real concern or interest. And finally, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act in the U.S. So you've got some in the U.S., you've got some in Europe with some very similar characteristics that create some of that concern.
Okay, well, I think we're going to dive a bit deeper into some of those acts, and then it might be nice if you look at some of those kind of key bigger ideas or principles which are coming out of it. There's the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, which I think President Biden signed off on 14th of January this year. So that's quite a recent one, and that bill will ban all imports from Xinjiang unless the government determines there is clear and convincing evidence that the products were not made with forced labor. It sounds quite a tough law because the onus is on the company to provide evidence it was not made with forced labor. Now, that seems to be a pretty strict rule there. How robust does the evidence need to be there?
The place that is causing clients today, in fact, I was just had a series of meetings last week, clients, and the thing that's top of mind for all of them in the apparel space is cotton traceability. And the at the foundation of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act in the fashion space is the genus of the fiber. Is the cotton grown in the Uyghur Autonomous Region, which is where the focus is? Historically, companies have had a very good handle on the first tier of their supply chain, I would suggest. But as you get further and further away from that cut and sew facility, you have less visibility. It is very difficult to confirm the backward links, if you will, as you go further upstream. And the number one concern there is, how do I know where the fiber that went to the spinner for the yarn, that was woven into that fabric, that was provided to the company that is cutting and sewing that product, where did that come from? And did it come from China? And if it came from China, what region of China did it come from? The systems haven't been designed or operated historically in a way that makes it very easy to look at that final product and go backwards in the supply chain to say, here's the source of the fiber. And given the significance of China as a producer of cotton,
I think it's a fifth of the world's cotton, isn't it?
Yep. And it's something north of 75% is actually produced in Northwest China. So China cotton by its nature is a challenge, and it's not a China problem because China exports, they're an exporter of cotton to a number of particularly in region countries. So companies are faced with production in Cambodia or Vietnam or Bangladesh, where they don't necessarily have the ability to say, oh, it can't be a problem for me because the fiber may well have originated outside of their country. And the question is, what country was the origin of the fiber? And if it was China fiber, is that fiber that is from a region other than the Uyghur Autonomous Region, where if it emanated from there, there is a presumption that it was made with forced labor, and you have to refute that presumption. The guidance, I believe, is due on the 21st of June from Customs and Border Protection in the U.S. as to what they're going to be looking for. But the easy answer is it's a high bar, and you, to the extent possible, or U.S. companies are certainly trying to avoid that linkage.
You said the guidance isn't due to June 21st. Is this law already fully operational, or is it kind of there's a sort of a bedding in period where people are getting to understand the process and the procedure to the point where the U.S. authorities will perhaps be slightly more lenient until people understand the guidance properly?
In U.S. law, right, there's a blanket withhold release order for any product that has that fiber in it. The difference is that there's a different legal mechanism that's making that happen. But in fact, today, if you're importing product into the U.S. that has fiber from Xinjiang, that's being stopped, and they can determine that that's the case, it's being stopped and not imported. So you have detentions of hundreds of containers of product over the last several months for that particular issue. The key there is it illuminates the larger supply chain, the larger issue across a number of these statutes related to supply chain transparency and understanding that supply chain all the way back to origin.
So what advice are you giving around this and other issues around the provenance?
It's really looking at understanding your suppliers, creating relationships that yield the information you need to have a level of confidence that those risks are understood and being managed. So we long gone are the days where companies can say, well, I don't know. I just, you know, I bought it from I bought it at a warehouse in the US. So it was FOB. I bought it here. I don't have any idea where it came from, and I shouldn't be held accountable or responsible for any of that stuff. So really understanding that supply base, who you're doing business with, who they do business with, what are the mechanisms in place? There are, you know, a number of efforts underway to identify scalable, reliable mechanisms to trace that stuff. But it is today not a system that is really well defined or well operating.
Eurofins, obviously, it's famous for all its different forms of testing. I think it's in the food industry and lots of other industries around. I think it's got like 900 laboratories across 50 countries in the world. Has Eurofins ever thought of trying to create a test for like the origin of certain fibers to determine where in the world they came from? Because if you could do that, that would sure hell be a real kind of good thing for society and also a good money spinner as well.
There is an, in fact, I had a call this morning. There's an active effort underway to develop a test method to reliably and accurately confirm provenance of cotton fiber, particularly, but you're going to have the same issue with viscose. You know, there are issues with other materials, but there have been, you know, a number of different solutions that have sort of been looked at as how can you reliably do that? What are the mechanisms that can be used to affirm that source, ideally by some natural mechanism or naturally occurring event?
What can happen to a company if it's found to have breached this particular law? Where are the risks and the penalties? Where do they lie?
There are certainly reputational risks, and we've seen plenty of examples of that in publications like Ecotextile News, where there are stories about companies having had product identified as having nexus to that region. So you've got reputational risks. You've very importantly got product risks. Right. So a product that's been detained, you're not allowed to import it. In some cases, it has to be destroyed.
Have there been that or any other examples recently where products have actually had to be destroyed because they couldn't prove the provenance or there was dispute about the provenance?
With provenance, typically you can send it back. You can send it to another market potentially. It's not in our business where you see things with product safety. You're certainly required to destroy it. I have a client that did actually have some stuff that they determined they were better off to just pay to have it disposed of than to ship it back, right? So it has a great deal to do with the value of the product. But the big impact there being, I don't have product. And if I don't have product, I don't sell product. And if I don't sell product, I don't sort of make money. And that's the objective in this business.
Okay, let's now turn our attention to closer to home. That's your home, although you are in Utah, so you're quite away from New York. But there's the Fashion Sustainability and Social Accountability Act in New York State. And my understanding is it will require all fashion companies to do business in New York, which includes the state and the city, and which generate more than $100 million in revenues, and they will be required to map at least 50% of the supply chains and disclose impacts such as greenhouse gas emissions, water footprint, and chemical use. Now, we did a podcast which touched on this earlier on this year, and it was still going through the legislative process. I thought that first we might just give us a very brief update on where we are with this legislation, how far it's gotten in the process.
It is still in the legislative process.
Yep.
So it is not settled law.
Yeah.
Having said that, it does provide a framework that we would expect will be considered and likely mimic in other jurisdictions. So we know that there's a similar statute moving in the state of Washington. One could logically expect to see something similar in the state of California. And most importantly, what happens with these things is they then become of interest to somebody at the federal level, and you end up with federal legislation that then captures the whole U.S.
And do you think it's likely that it will pass in New York?
I think that in its current form, it likely won't. I think there's a lot of push-pull around that, but there will be something. There are elements of it that are difficult to argue with, for lack of a better way of thinking about it.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about that then, because I've picked up on a couple of interesting aspects of it, which to me demonstrate there's got to be some sort of pushback somewhere, because there's they only have to map 50% of the supply chain. So it makes me think, well, at some point they wanted 100%, but some group pushed back up to 50%. Where do you think the kind of the fault lines exist with this legislation at the moment?
Well, I think some of the elements around not just supply chain mapping, right? Supply chain mapping is a gigantic undertaking. We touched on this earlier, that companies historically have had a good sense of the first tier and maybe the second tier of the supply chain. But supply chain mapping really has you going all the way back to the source of the fiber, the farm, if you will. And that's the, you know, when I look at this and the EU directive, much the same, it is.
I think we're going to come into that after this. So yeah.
One of the really big areas of concern is the scope, right? Taking you all the way back to materials, whether it's, you know, 50%, 25%, 100% of your supply chain. It is a giant undertaking that is incredibly dynamic, right? If it was possible, but if you had a really clear vision of your supply chain in 2019 in the fashion business, and you were to overlay that on where you are today, the changes have been really significant. The changes, you know, if you think about what we touched on earlier with regard to cotton from certain sources in China, the prohibition against including that in your product, which has already happened with the withhold release orders, has had significant impacts on companies that are sourcing cotton products. So they're very dynamic. They are very long, have literally folks, you know, have 100 first tier suppliers. They may have 4,000 nodes in their supply chain in total. Understanding who those folks are, keeping track of them, particularly where you don't typically have the ability to affect the decisions that are being made about those relationships. So a company has a really clear line to who they buy product from. They may be able to influence who that first tier gets materials from. When you get beyond that, you're sort of dependent upon working with people that have shared values that are aligned with your expectations, because companies are not looking at where did the button supplier get the polymers that they're using to make, you know, a button.
What advice do you give there? Because is there like a version of a de minimis where there's so marginal the input that maybe people won't pay so much attention? They're looking to kind of catch the big fish, like huge carbon emissions and very poor, you know, labor rights, et cetera, et cetera.
The challenge there becomes that it's the de minimis guys, it's the smaller guys that are not necessarily in your field of vision where you have the highest risk.
Oh, interesting.
Less sophisticated users, they are the folks who may not completely understand expectations or values. Right. So it's interesting because lots of companies have had this experience where they have pretty robust programs and they're engaging their largest supplier and they end up with a negative event tied to, you know, somebody that they did one order with somewhere that wasn't subject to their process. And so some amount of vigilance around your process and being able to articulate that it is applicable to your entire supply base or your supply base within scope. And how do you, again, the challenge with these statutes is they are rapidly expanding that scope. So you suddenly aren't responsible just for your house being clean, but your neighbor's house and your neighbor's neighbor's house. Understanding who your neighbor's neighbor is the first step in that process.
Essentially, I mean, these laws are pretty far-reaching and robust, and they require firms to do some really serious thinking, soul-searching, looking at their whole business model in a way to ensure that they continue to perform in a way which is financially worthwhile, but also, you know, fits in with all the kind of ESG requirements. I mean, it's a big deal, isn't it, I would say?
It's a huge deal. And it gets at, you know, I had referenced there were sort of two legs that companies are really concerned about. And the second one really drives it, which is almost all of these things have some set of requirements around preventing, ceasing, minimizing, or mitigating the risks associated with adverse impacts. So never before have we been in an environment where companies had to not only understand what was going on in those supply base, but equally addressing the issues, right? So three levels down in my supply chain, I have this risk and I've realized the risk has presented itself and I have underage workers. Now, under the scope of the statutes, what you're seeing is an expectation that you're reporting on what you did about it. So not just I have a process, but I have a process. The process tells me these kinds of things, and here is how I've addressed those issues. And I think that's the piece that is most concerning, because it's ground that really hasn't been covered historically, and now it's not being covered in an ESG report that is, you know, in some places a marketing document, but now it's being covered in statutory filings that are suddenly not looked at the same way as a glossy brochure might be.
And that's a very good point to ask you about statutory filings. I understand that, and you perhaps can fill me in here with your expertise around what sort of filings we're talking about here, but there can be sometimes personal liabilities attached to filings which are incorrect or don't meet certain standards in relation to ESG. Is that right?
That is the direction that this is moving, exactly. That there are, when you look at things like the proposed regulations on climate disclosures from the SEC, suddenly think about it as information that's being subject to the same kinds of liability that you see with financial information, right? So putting ESG information, you've got a similar sort of thing going on in Europe, right? So suddenly information about carbon performance or social performance, you could end up with officer and director liability for misreporting that information.
You're talking about that personal liability. Is it a good mechanism to get companies to focus their minds, do you think?
Well, I think what happens is when you create those expectations around liability, suddenly you have questions on a regular and recurring basis at the C-suite level, at the board level. I mentioned earlier that when you look at the track in our space, it has historically gone up and down with events. And way that manifests itself is you end up with boards of directors, members of the board saying, gosh, I saw this issue. What are we doing about it as a company? There's a flurry of activity. I think companies who, it's in their core values historically, maybe we're a little more steady state, but that it is very clear that there is a migration up and down. And what we see today, and it presents itself in lots of ways, but the creation of senior positions within companies to manage ESG risk, expectations that there are members of the board that have specific expertise or knowledge and experience is fundamentally changing the importance of this, really moving it in the same direction that financial information is. And I think that's the big change, right? At the end of the day, when it's viewed as an important element of how investors are making business decisions or investing decisions, you need reliable information upon which to make those decisions. And that information is suddenly subject to the same kind of scrutiny that similar information is.
Is there a parallel here with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which was introduced in the United States in 2002 and placed requirements on all US public company boards of directors and management, which was a reaction to a number of major corporate and accounting scandals, including Enron and WorldCom?
Right. Sarbanes-Oxley, in addition to creating some requirements and responsibilities for individuals and companies, did create a set of expectations about control systems and management process. And when you look at the SEC proposed rules on climate change, it's doing exactly the same thing. It is requiring companies to begin to capture and reliably present information on their carbon performance. I could envision more around liability and responsibility, but the foundational information piece is in fact already moving. It's not something that we're going to see in 4 or 5 years. I think you could see conceptually, some of the control elements, if in fact in the, you get 5 years out and suddenly people figure out that the reliability of that carbon information is very poor and it's impacted decision-making, more regulation and requirements around that, but we're not there yet.
We don't want to leave the EU out of this conversation, and they're introducing some mandatory due diligence legislation to make companies responsible for the environmental and social issues in their supply chains. Do you know what's going on there, when this is likely to be enacted, and maybe like if you can draw any kind of comparisons between the risks that poses compared to what we've been talking about so far?
Sure. The mandatory human rights due diligence, the EU directive, really is providing a framework for country-specific statutes. You see that already existing in France, in Germany, and very much there are significant parallels between the things that we've talked about previously in the discussion here. I think one of the things that's most important to your listeners is that apparel and textiles is identified as a high-risk sector in that directive. And what that says is that the thresholds in terms of the company size and those things is actually lower in apparel textile. So while some of that we would look at conceptually and say, maybe there's less concern based on our industry for a dimension of this, carbon as an example, as contrasted to a petrochemical company. In fact, the sector has been specifically identified as higher risk. The statutes all have some of the same concerning elements around the scope going all the way back in the supply chain, these requirements to prevent, minimize, or cease negative impacts. So again, if there's, you know, what have you, and disclosure about that. So it's not only that you have to do it, but you have to sort of describe it. So if there is child labor six steps removed and you're aware of it, the expectation that you've done something about it and can talk about what you've done is fundamentally different from where we are today. We have largely moved from an environment where statutory considerations were a lot about your perception, your thoughts, your values. You look at the UK Modern Slavery Act, there is an awful lot of, tell me what your policy is. What do you think? This is very much, what do you do and what have you done? Which is a big change from where we are today.
And what do you think about that? Do you think that's a good thing?
To a point, it is positive because it will drive change more consistently. I think the emergence of statutory requirements and that level of oversight or expectation around the reliability of the information is important. I think that this is a place where there are companies who are doing really good things. There are places where companies are talking about doing really good things. And it is always challenging to try to figure out, you know, how do you make sure your rhetoric matches your realities? So helping to level that field a little bit, more importantly, helping to get action and activity so that you're improving conditions, you're making the lives of the people making those products better is an important element.
You paused for a second when you answered that question. You said to a point. Is there a downside to this?
I think if the scope and breadth of those things is particularly broad, as it could, you can read the legislation in that way, I worry that nobody's going to be able to do it and certainly do it well. And that's going to result in, you know, a sort of protracted deployment that doesn't get us the benefits that one would hope from those things, right? At the end of the day, the objective ought be, how do we make sure that people throughout the supply chain are working under safe, lawful, and humane conditions. And just as companies are absolutely committed to quality of the product that they put in the consumer's hand, understanding that an element of that is the conditions and treatment of the people that got that product to that point.
We've spent most of this podcast discussing a lot of the current or forthcoming regulatory frameworks, which will affect the way in which companies and some of your clients will see risk in this industry. But we haven't really talked much about the whole voluntary side, the voluntary code of conduct and certain sort of voluntary standards, et cetera, which are non-statutory. How will they kind of intersect with the new regulations? Because it might well be that some of these existing voluntary programs, worthwhile and worthy that they might be, they may actually fall short perhaps of the new regulations, and then in a way not be as useful as people think they are.
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things that we will see over the next 18 months is an evaluation by the program owners, their scope, depth, execution protocols to ensure that the resultant work is viewed as sufficiently credible to meet the requirements of that statutory due diligence. What you see today is we've seen a great, you know, and again, COVID drove some of this, but it has been very much the case that increasingly companies are working through collaborative programs as opposed to doing it by themselves for themselves. It really gets at a mechanism to reduce audit fatigue. Makes very good sense, but it only makes sense when the resultant work is of sufficient scope and depth to create reliable information upon which to make business decisions. Those programs will evaluate themselves and ultimately will be evaluated by regulators, but it is the case that you will see scrutiny of voluntary efforts to ensure that they are sufficiently robust to meet the expectation.
That all makes perfect sense, Randy. Final question for you today. What advice do you have for anyone working in this industry, worried about the risk to their brand or reputation, allied with maybe falling short of new regulations? I guess a good starting point would perhaps come and talk to you.
I think that companies need to have a mechanism to evaluate the risks in their supply chain, understanding their supply base, and then working with someone who has the experience and knowledge to be able to evaluate that network for where those risks exist, whether they are geographic risks or characteristic risks in that supply base, what kind of manufacturers you're working with, what kind of relationships you have, and then making sure that you're on that journey of understanding those risks, mitigating them consistent with your risk tolerance.
And anyone listening to this podcast today, if they want to find out more about your team's work in this area, what's the best way of getting in touch?
I'm somebody who's got a really open telephone line. I'm certainly reachable by email and telephone, would be happy to talk about the work that we're doing. And my contact information is also right there on our website.
That's brilliant, Randy. Now, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day. Well, it's only just started for you. I'm halfway through it. You're out in Utah. But thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating. It's going to be of enormous help to a lot of our listeners. Thanks a lot, Randy.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Ecotextile News. This has been a great pleasure, and I really enjoyed the opportunity.
Thanks again to Randy. If you want to reach out to him and his team, we've got the contact details in the show notes. Don't forget, there's plenty of other editions to listen to in our back catalogue on helpful topics such as how to measure your carbon emissions and water impact, or how the blockchain can improve transparency in the industry. All are available now on Apple, Spotify, Google, and most of your other favourite listening apps. We'll be back very soon with another exciting guest. In the meantime, please do feel free to like and share our podcast. I'm Philip Berman. Thank you for listening. Until next time.